our parsha is Parshas Kedoshim. This week we read Achrimot and Kedoshim. We will focus on Kedoshim. Our parsha has the second most number of mitzvot in the Torah. Kiseite has the most, and this is second in line. And our parsha has mitzvot that pertain from man and his fellow man to man and his creator. Ordinarily we go through the parsha with an overview and then we go in depth. Tonight I think we'll have to go in depth off the bat, because you know, each mitzvah deserves its own discussion. The parsha begins with an unusual introduction. Hashem tells Moshe, "Daber el kol adat bnei Yisrael," speak to the congregation. And the question is, why this introduction? Other parshiyos begin with God said to Moshe, "Go tell the Jews." By the Hashem, Moshe leimor, and then the parsha continues. And so Rashi right away tells us that this parsha is unique, that Moshe gathered the Jewish people in and said, "Now we have to talk." And this parsha was given with a special gathering. You know, they gathered everyone to Madison Square Garden or Kikar Rabin or whatever the equivalent is. They put everyone together. They blew the trumpets. Everyone gathered. And Moshe said, "Now listen up." And the parsha begins with a commandment. Kedoshim to you. Be holy. And that needs understanding. What is God saying when God says, be holy? So, what does the word kadosh mean?
Holy.
Kadosh seems to mean holy. Kadosh seems to mean separate. And here we have an important machloket Rashi Ramban. Rashi says kadosh means separate, and being that the last point that was discussed is the prohibited relations, the women that were prohibited from marrying, so kedoshim to you is an indication, separate yourself beyond what the Torah says. Meaning the Torah just told you those relationships which are basically harig v'al-yavar. A person should rather give up his life than transgress those. Incest, a person's sister, a person's aunt. The Torah says a whole list of women that are prohibited and very weighty. And then the Torah begins our parsha and says, now be holy. So be holy means go beyond the call of duty. It's not enough just what I told you there. And Rashi describes it as separate yourself from the prohibited relations. So how do we do that? Says the Rambam, the nature of the human being is that he's attracted to this. And the nature of the human being is that there are certain things that are lead-ins to these transgressions. And the lead-ins are often underestimated. Meaning, we have one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not covet. So one of the Ten Commandments is to control our desire, to control our thought. Now, the Rambam writes, when a person sees or looks at something that he's not supposed to look at and thinks something he's not supposed to think, that's something that's very tough to do tshuva on. Because a person feels like, what did I do wrong? A guy sees an improper picture and then he turns away and goes to the Beis Medrash and learns Gemara. And he thinks he left the picture on the computer screen. But the Torah says, no, that was a moment of sin and that moment stays with him. Until he works to take that out of him, that's there. And the Rambam says we don't feel it, because a person can be walking in the street and let his eyes linger and let his eyes wander and let his mind wander, and then a minute later he's back to where he was, and a minute later he could walk into shul and daven, and he could walk into Yom Kippur. You know, on Yom Kippur we read the prohibitions from last week, from Parshas Achrimos, the prohibited women. So the commentaries say, you know, Yom Kippur, the holiest day, why are we reading that about the women you're not supposed to go with? Say the commentaries. One understanding is because Yom Kippur is a time that everyone shows up to shul. So the women wear all their beautiful hats and everyone's all dressed up. And you know what? I know it's Yom Kippur. But the nature of man is, beauty and the beast. So our sages instituted a reminder. At Mincha, we read Achrimos. We read about the prohibited relations in Achrimos. So a person can be at the holiest day and yet his mind wanders. And a person doesn't feel the weight of these sins. But the Torah warns us that there are the biblical prohibitions, thou shalt not covet, so one of the Ten Commandments. And then there's another mitzvah in our parsha, be holy. And holiness is not something that can be measured. You know, you could have the longest beard, you could wear the biggest hat, and at the end of the day, no one knows what's going on in your mind. There's no measure. No one knows. You know. God knows. But no one else knows. And this is a commandment to go beyond the call of duty. What leads a person to sin, says the Rambam? Frivolity. A person who's joking around with people of the opposite gender. A person who isn't careful about yichud, being alone with the opposite gender. The Rambam says these are lead-ins. And very often about these lead-ins we're lax. People feel like, no, big deal. So I'm alone in the house. Why does something have to happen? About 5 years ago, there was, I don't know what exactly his role is. He was something big in the Israeli theater. And he went on record, he went to the media and he said, you know, the religious are paranoid. The religious, that they don't let a man and a woman be alone in the house together, they don't shake a woman's hand, they're paranoid. They've gone too far. It was very interesting that the same column that interviewed him, 2 months later, had a record of how there was a court order, girls had said had been improper towards them in the theater, and that the same man who said, we went too far, proved himself in the same column. Now, I didn't know this, I don't read newspapers, but a friend of mine, chavrusa of mine, pointed this out to me, that we sometimes look at the halacha and we forget how humane the halacha is. The halacha understands exactly what we're made of. It's the exact opposite. It's not that the halacha is oversensitive, it's that we really are that way. And it all takes is opening any newspaper. You don't have to open today's newspaper. You could open last week's or last month's or last year's. And you read about a lot of people doing improper things because the nature of man is that we're attracted. And that's why our parsha has to tell us, don't just go with the call of duty. Kiddushim to you. Be holy. Go beyond that. Holiness is about not going till the line. It's about making our borders before that. In Chassidut they say that a sign of a person who loves Hashem is a person who is Kadesh atzmecha b'mutar lecha. Kedoshim to you, our sages said, Kadesh atzmecha, sanctify yourself, b'mutar lecha, and that which is permitted to you. Don't just say, well, that's prohibited, so I won't do it. But this is permitted, so that's okay. No, if you go beyond that, Kadesh atzmecha, sanctify yourself, b'mutar lecha, and that which is permitted to you, that's what Kedoshim, that's what holiness is about. And in Chassidut they say, that's a level of working to loving Hashem. You know, a guy who's scared of the of his parents or his boss or God, not to even be mentioned in the same sentence, but along the same theme. So then he says, what they said is what I do. I'll be very careful to do what they said. But when you love the person in question, then you're not just interested in doing what they said, you're interested in going with the spirit of the matter and going beyond the call of duty. So Chassidut takes this concept of Kedusha and says Kedusha is indicative of love. You guys, yeah, clear, yeah?
Okay.
There's a famous Ramban here, Nachmanides. Nachmanides doesn't agree with Rashi's interpretation of this mitzvah. Nachmanides says, technically, a person could be in line with the mitzvahs of the Torah and lead a pretty disgusting life. A guy wakes up in the morning and he says, I'm allowed to marry 15 wives, so every hour I'll be with a different wife. I'm allowed to eat kosher meat, no prohibition against eating kosher meat, so in the morning I'll eat 3 pounds of steak, in the afternoon I'll eat 3 pounds of broiled meat, and at night we'll go out for shawarma. I'm allowed to drink wine. Where in the Torah does it prohibit me from drinking wine? It's all kosher, but that's so. I'll wake up in the morning and I'll have this meat, well that goes with fine red wine, and that meat, that goes with the fine white wine. And the third meat, well, we'll see what new wine is out on the market. A guy could live a whole life, a gluttonous, filthy life, and he's within the confines of the Torah. He says, you know, I have 15 wives. What's wrong? I'm allowed to have relations with my wife as often as I want, so long as she's pure and I'm pure and we're both consenting adults. What's wrong? Technically, a guy could live within the confines of halacha and lead a very, very low life. So what's to prevent him from that? Says the Ramban, that's this mitzvah. Be holy. When the Torah says be holy, the Torah is saying, you know what I want from you. It's not just about what's permitted and prohibited. You know what kind of life I want you to lead. This mitzvah is what precludes us from going within the letter of the law and going against the spirit of the law. Now, obviously, this is a little bit difficult to define, you know. Where do you draw the line? If I have three slices of pizza, am I being a glutton? What about four? You know, right? So this isn't something which you can really sit and delineate where the lines are. But at the end of the day, we understand the direction the Torah is leading us. Yes?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, doesn't the Torah, apart from this, also it pushes you to moderation? That would go against what you were saying, that it would be allowed.
It's the spirit of the law, but there's no specific prohibition against having 10 pounds of meat a day. It's kosher, it's kosher. The Torah then gives us a commandment to have awe of our parents. We know we have a commandment to kabed, honor our parents. Mora, that's in our parsha, to have what we might translate as fear, but really it's awe. And then we have a mitzvah of not deriding our parents. Those are the biblical mitzvot with regard to our parents. So a person has to have kabed, honor his parents. Honoring his parents is what we might call respect. You don't cut them off when they're in the middle of saying something. You don't disagree with them. And having awe or fear of our parents is more like what we would call serving our parents, right? So if a parent needs... I'm sorry, it's the other way around. Fearing our parents is... that we don't cut them off. Honoring our parents is more like service. That we parent needs help putting on their shoes, you put them on for them. Parent needs you to buy clothing for them. You buy the things they need. Those are really the mitzvot. Now kibud and mora, these mitzvot of honoring and showing respect, not deriding them. We don't have to spend money for these mitzvot, but at the same time, we're not allowed to cause them any pain. Meaning, if it'll cost you money not to cause them pain, then you have to pay that money. Meaning, if a parent walks in and takes your wallet and he's going to throw it into the river, so you could grab the wallet back, but you can't fight him to take the wallet back. You can't hurt the parent. If a parent walks in and starts spitting at his kid, so the kid could walk away. He doesn't have to stand there and swallow all that, but he can't, like someone else would come. You know, if someone's pushing you, you push him back. You don't have to stand there and be pushed. You shouldn't kill him. But you don't have to, you know, self-defense is legitimate in halacha. But with regard to parents, you really have to just run away from the situation. You're not allowed to cause them any pain, even at costs. If this comes into play, you know, if a parent is abusive and then their relationship is harmful to the kids, sometimes it's emotionally harmful. Parents that have been abusive, sometimes their kids can't function when they're in the room. Because of what they've done, that's a different story. Then we enter the realm where we say, yeah, a person doesn't have to give up his own life for his parents. A person could distance himself from his parents. A person has to find ways out of it. But technically, if a person is a mature adult and his parents are now senile and they don't know exactly what they're doing and they're not exactly behaving the way he would like them to behave, he has to be careful not to pain them, he has to respect them, and he has to deal with them in the way that's best for them. Sometimes that means getting a foreign worker to deal with them. The Torah is careful in telling us that when it comes to our mother, we have to respect her and our father, because the nature of a person is that he has more fear, he has more awe of his father than his mother. The father is tough as nails, so okay, the father, you're gonna think twice before you cut him off, interrupt him, correct him, disagree with him. The mother is softer, so our nature is that we have less what we might call respect. We have an easier time honoring her. But we'll also have an easier time cutting her off, disagreeing with her, all those things. So that's why the Torah says the mother before the father with regard to this mitzvah. When it comes to honoring, so there our nature is being that our mothers have a warmer relationship with us, if we could call it that, or an easier relationship with us. So the nature of a person is he gives honor to his mother more naturally than his father. And therefore the Torah says, honor your father and your mother. The things that, okay. The Torah says, you have these mitzvot and keep my Shabbos. What's the connection? Hashem says, if your parents tell you to do something that's against the Shabbos, don't listen to them. They also have to respect me. And this starts taking us into a certain balance that we're going to see throughout our parsha. On the one hand, the Torah stresses the mitzvot between man and his fellow man. On the other hand, the Torah gives us a balance. You know, if your parents tell you to do things that are against the Torah, so the Torah says, don't listen. They have to listen to me just like you have to listen to me. And if you think about it, that's a tremendous balance, that limit, that's put on the mitzvos regarding our parents. The Torah says, "Al tifnu al halilim." Don't even turn to look at the idols, and that means that a person shouldn't be taking tours of places of idol worship. We don't go touring churches and things like that. We don't look at the beautiful things that they did. We don't even comment positively about it. And again, this is an attitude that the Torah is developing within us. You don't go looking and saying, "Ah, that's beautiful." Go look at shuls and see how beautiful they are. And the Torah even refers to idols in a derogatory way. The Torah calls them elilim. Elilim means those that are nothing, like from al, not of value. And Chazal were always careful, and the Torah was careful, that whenever they spoke about idols, so they'd switch the name in a way that was derogatory. You'll notice we call him Oso Aish, that man, Yoshka. We don't even give him the honor of calling him by name. You guys ever notice that? There's a reason to it, because we're not even willing to give that much legitimacy to it. The name for idols is Elilim. The root of it is El Al. Al. Foreign. Notice it's not El. Here's an important difference. El with a tsere, as though it would be E-I-L, means a power. El with a segol, like E-L, so that's synonymous with al. The segol and the patach in Hebrew are interchangeable. The A and the E, they're similar vowels, they're interchangeable. Yeah? El and al are interchangeable. That's why you'll find sometimes in the Rishonim they refer to a segol as a patach. When you read Rishonim, you'll see they refer to the E, the segol, the E, elilim, as a patach. Because really, grammatically, they're almost identical. So elilim is like alilim. If it would be elilim, if it would be like E-I, then it would be like the powerful ones. Okay, but that deserves a longer discussion. The Torah forbids us from making figurines. Sometimes a person says, you know, so I have a store, so there are tourists, so what's wrong if I'm selling crosses? That's what they want to buy. No. That's what you see in our parsha and in other places. The Torah tells us we have a mitzvah in our parsha, that a mitzvah of pigul. You guys familiar with the mitzvah of pigul? When you bring a sacrifice, you have to do it with the intent that it will be eaten in the proper time and eaten in the proper place. And if the kohen who brings the sacrifice says, "I'm going to eat this on the third day after the Torah permits me to eat it, or I'll eat it, I'll take it back home to Netanya." So the fact that he says he's going to do it, even though he didn't do anything, the mere thought of eating it in an improper time or improper place disqualifies the korban. This is a complicated concept. The Torah tells us we have a mitzvah of giving to the poor. So when you harvest your field, when you reach the corner, leave over from the corner. Corner in Hebrew is? Peah. Okay, so now, let's imagine my chumash is the field. You guys see, I'm harvesting the field. This could be a corner. This could be a corner. This could be a corner. How big is the corner? How do you decide? So?
It was laid down, wasn't it? In the spot.
It was?
It's been decided how much it should be.
So technically, biblically, we say every morning, Elu devarim she'en lehem shiur. The following things do not have a defined amount in the Torah. Ha-peah, the first example we give is peah. Peah doesn't say in the Torah how big the corner is. You want to be a nice guy, you have a good year, you could give more. You have a bad year, the poor also had a bad year, they're also more hungry, you could give more. The rabbis instituted 1/60. Rabbinically, they instituted 1/60. But you could add to that. Now, when the Torah describes giving the peah, the Torah describes it as you harvest your field, do not finish off the corner. Leave over the corner. So we understand from that the Torah wanted you to give the last corner of your field. So the question is, why? Ordinarily, we're accustomed that we give the first fruits to God. Why over here does the Torah describe it as do not finish off the corner? So there are a few interesting reasons that are given. One reason that's given is because if you could give it at any random corner, then the poor would always have to be there to ensure that they would get their lot. If they know that it's the last corner, they could come in the morning, estimate when you'll get there, and in accordance with that, they'll come back and take it. You don't waste the poor's time. So that's one consideration of the Torah. Another consideration of the Torah was that if you could give a corner at random, then a person would call his relative or his buddy And he'd say, you know, wait till there's no one around, and then I'll give over that corner and you could have it. Now, the Torah wanted everyone should get from it. It should be fair play. So the Torah said, your last corner. When you hit the last corner, don't finish it off. If a person could give over a different corner, then people who are looking and they see him finish off the last two corners or the last corner, they would think this guy didn't fulfill the mitzvah. So the Torah didn't want there should be chashad. The Torah didn't want that people would be suspicious of someone else. So the Torah said, leave over the last corner. So whoever comes will always see there's that corner still left. And from here we learn the important concept that the Torah wanted us to be concerned with chashad. The Torah didn't want us to do things that leave room for people to think I've done something wrong. If you have a house that has two entrances on two sides of the building, so if you're going to light Hanukkah candles on one side, the people who walk by on the other side might think, hey, he doesn't light Hanukkah candles. So because of that, we say light on both sides, unless you could see both sides at the same time. This is this concept, that we are concerned with what people think about us. We don't want people to think we're doing something improper. If you have a bathhouse, the public bathhouse is yours. Everyone knows it's your bathhouse. So you're going to go, after 5 years that it's your bathhouse, you think to yourself, gee, I close my bathhouse an hour before Shabbos every Shabbos, and I could only reopen Matzei Shabbos. I'm losing 1/7 of the profit. Let me give it to a non-Jew. I'll sell it to him on Shabbatot, and on Shabbos let him do the business. What's wrong? I'll tell you what's wrong. One of the problems is that everyone knows it's your bathhouse. It says Binyamin Zwicker's bathhouse on top. You know, everyone sees it's open on Shabbos. What are they thinking? What's with Binyamin? So we have to be concerned about chashat. It's the halacha. I mean, it's relevant to if you hire builders, you hire a kablan, you sign a contract with someone to build your apartment. Zwicker Towers, yeah? And then they want to work on Shabbos. They say, we're not Jewish. What do you care when we do it? So one of the issues we're concerned with is, what does it look like? What are people thinking? So there's a concept of marisayin, things that look bad, and then there's a concept of chashad, and they're not necessarily synonymous. Chashad is a level where people have to assume you're doing things wrong. And even there we say, be careful, because people are going to assume you're doing something wrong. You know, the guy who walks by your left entrance, when he sees there's no Hanukkah candle there, why doesn't he think, well, maybe it's in the other entrance? Why doesn't he think that? He assumes, well, if he didn't light here, he didn't light there. What a bum. Right? Well, maybe he's the bum. Why is he thinking badly about you? So Torah says, no, even so. A guy's walking by your field. He sees you harvested the last corner. Why doesn't he consider, you know, there are three other corners? The Torah says, no, people will think what's worse. They shouldn't, but they will. And even though we, on the one hand, when we judge others, we have to think positively. But when we behave, we have to take into account the way others will view us. And a person has to be concerned about chashad as well. One of the mitzvos is that if you have a vineyard, so you have to leave for the poor the kernels that fall down. If it's a single kernel or two kernels of grapes, you leave it for the poor. Or if you have clusters of grapes that did not form well. And those are called oleilot. What does it mean they didn't form well? If the branches don't lie on one another nicely, that's called ketef. Ketef is when you carry something on your shoulder. It's placed on your shoulder, that's ketef. So if the branches lie on one another nicely, that's ketef. If the branches come to a tight cluster at the bottom of the cluster, that's called netef. If it's lacking either one, that's called oleilot. The poor grape clusters. Those grape clusters you're supposed to leave for the poor. The Torah warns us not to steal. In the Ten Commandments it said not to steal. That was a reference to kidnapping. Here the Torah says not to steal. That's a reference to common theft. The Torah says don't lie. Don't lie. So that's a reference to don't deny that you owe someone money. And the Torah says do not swear in my name falsely. So the Torah is saying, don't steal, don't lie, don't swear falsely. These lead into one another. If you steal, you'll have to lie. You'll have to cover yourself up. You'll have to deny it. You'll lie in denial. You'll lie again. You'll end up swearing falsely. And a false vow, our sages say, brings terrible destruction to the world. What's a person saying when he takes a vow? He's saying, I promise what I'm saying is true. By the honor of God that what I'm saying is true. When a person is taking a vow, what he's technically saying is, by the honor of God that what I'm saying is true. Well, if he's lying, what's he saying about the honor of God? And so before our sages would allow a person to take a vow in court, they would warn him. They would tell him, we want you to know that it, when a person lies, when he takes a vow, terrible destruction comes to the world. God sends plagues to the world. God doesn't take it lightly. It is one of the things that brings all kinds of natural disasters to the world. Take it with that weight. And sometimes a person will say, you know, all I did was I stole a little bit. And then I had to lie. You know, what was I supposed to do? Admit. And then I had to take a false vow. So the Torah says, nip it at the bud. The same concept we discussed earlier. So don't steal. That's what the Torah began with. And we have to think in advance where it will lead us. The average guy, when he cheats on his taxes, does he think he's going to end up in court? Does he really think about what will be when he's audited? One of the things the Torah is training us, the Torah is training us to think what will be the outcome of what I do. Very often we like to assume things will work themselves out. It'll be okay. I'll only be there for 2 months. I know I won't have a minion, but only 2 months. You know, what's the worst that can happen? No. Someone once asked me, he says, I just want to go for 2 years to finish a doctorate to business university out in the Midwest. But I'll do online dating, and I don't think there's any chance in the world I'd ever be attracted to a non-Jewish girl. I don't think it could ever happen. You know, I come from a home where it can't happen. So my answer is, I wouldn't trust myself there. You know, I also come from an Orthodox home. And I'm married, and I wouldn't trust myself there. Put yourself in a situation for 2 years in a place where you're surrounded with all these good-looking non-Jewish girls, and you think you'll stand up to the test? I hope you will. But why put yourself there? You know, we pray every day not to put ourselves in a situation of a test. And there's a saying in Hebrew that says, a smart person can get himself out of a problem. A brilliant person avoids the problem. So the Torah here is telling us there's a course of action. A person who begins by doing something wrong can anticipate that this is where it's going to lead him. And the trick is, nip it at the bud. Don't cheat on your taxes. Don't come and ask the question, well, if they take me to court, can I lie? Well, my baby, come on, you know, everyone does something. So why did you come to this question? You shouldn't have done what was wrong to begin with. The Torah says, lo tashok et re'acha. What does it mean, lo tashok? So that's a machlokes. Pashut pshat is that it means you owe someone money and you tell him, come back tomorrow. You have the money, why aren't you paying him? There's a big mitzvah to pay on time. So I want to go off on a slight tangent here because there's a mistake that guys often make. There's a biblical prohibition of withholding someone's wages. But as with many biblical prohibitions, they give us a little bit of an insight into human nature. We've had a lot of guys that took jobs and they weren't paid. So we have to remember Rabbi Wein's rule. Don't confuse Jews with Judaism. Judaism is what we should be doing. Jews don't always live up to Judaism, I'm embarrassed to say. We should, we work on it, we try it. So we had a guy who got a job, and comes his first payday, and the boss says, you know, I'm a little bit tight on cash, we'll get to you. So he's an innocent guy, he continues working. To make a long story short, after 3 months, he never got his paycheck. The boss got 3 months worth of good work out of him, and he's never gotten his paycheck. So there's a biblical prohibition against this, against withholding wages, even if you'll pay him in the end. But the fact that the Torah has to go into this type of thievery should give us a little bit of insight into the fact that this type of thievery is out there, and we have to be with it. So another guy came to get his paycheck, and they told him, you know, you need to fill out Form A and B and C and D. And he came to me and he said, should I play hardball with them and tell them, hey, you're supposed to pay me, it's the end of the month? And I said, no, because they're right. Legally, you do have to fill out those forms. So you didn't know about it. Fine. They're a big organization. They don't have to run after you and tell you which forms you have to fill out. So you'll have to swallow it. Maybe we'll get you a loan. And don't play hardball. You know, if they're legitimate in withholding your wages because legally you need certain forms, fine. I understand that. If a guy's been paying you on time for a year now, and then 1 month he's a little bit late on the paycheck, okay, there's what to think about. I'm not saying a person should react right away. But when you get a new job and the new boss is not paying you, just remember we discussed this one. So keep your eyes open. I've seen too many people working with the best intentions for months and never getting paid. And the more time that passes, the less the boss has an interest to pay you. Because he has more profit with every month that passes. Torah says, Lo tashok et re'acha. And the Torah aligns it with Lo tigzol, you shall not steal. We should never be doing this. The Torah says it's a biblical prohibition. The Torah even goes so far as to give us a commandment of holding wages overnight. You have a babysitter. She worked for you that night. You're supposed to pay her that night. You're not supposed to wait till the next morning. You have a painter. He did a job today. You have a mitzvah to pay him today. There's a biblical prohibition against waiting till tonight. You have to pay him within that period. If he worked during the daylight hours, you have to pay him during the daylight hours. If he worked during the nighttime hours, during the nighttime hours. If he worked at day and he finished his job at night, when he finished his job at night, you have till the end of that night to pay him. You didn't pay him that night? That's a biblical transgression. And we learned the Chafetz Chaim in the Avat Chesed about a year ago. We learned a whole chapter about this biblical prohibition. All the details of this halacha. What happens if you're short on cash? What happens? Go to the ATM. Go get a loan. We went through all the details of the halacha. So, a person has a mitzvah not to delay paying wages of a sachir, a hired worker. You know, if you have a guy that's working for you for a month, you don't have to pay him every night. If it's a guy that you hired for a day or for 3 days for a specific job, so then at the end of the job, you're supposed to pay. Again, we can't go into all the details, but we have to be familiar with the concept. The Torah says, "Lo tekalel chiresh." We have a special prohibition against cursing a deaf person. And here the Torah is teaching us the sensitivity we're supposed to have to those who are on a lower rung in society. People who have different types of handicaps. The Talmud explains, the nature of a person is that when he has a handicap, his soul has an element of sadness to it. He has to contend with life differently than the rest of us. And so the Torah gives us a special prohibition against doing something that will hurt him. Because the fact that a person has to contend his whole life with being deaf, so that means that he is going to be more sensitive. And when you say something derogatory to him, he will take it more to heart. And so the Torah gives us a special prohibition. Don't curse him. He's going to notice that you've done something hurtful to him, and that's a biblical prohibition. At the same time, Chazal indicated to us, we have to be aware that because a person has a certain disability or a certain hindrance, so sometimes Chazal gave us another insight into his nature, an insight that is not relevant to this mitzvah, but once we've started discussing them, we should also understand this. And that is that the Torah warned us that people with certain disabilities can also have innate cruelty. That when a person grows up his whole life with a disability, he's going to feel naturally, whether he likes it or not, he's going to feel a certain grudge against society. Why am I different than anyone else? And that's why there were instances where our sages would not accept testimony from a person with a disability, because they were concerned that the witness might have a little bit too much cruelty to him. And maybe the truth isn't exactly the way he's saying it. We want testimony from someone who we can rely on, will tell us an accurate picture of what happened. And so in the Talmud, in Sanhedrin, the Talmud says there are types of testimony which we will not accept from a person who has a disability. And the Meiri explains this insight, that our teachers, our sages understood that within the soul of a person with a disability there exists a certain bitterness towards society which can express itself in forms of cruelty. And we learned about this. We learned a famous story about Rabbi Yeshua. You guys remember? Rabbi Yeshua, I think it was Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya who was questioned by the Roman emperor about people with disabilities. It's in Rav Nissim Magon's story work. And he proved to him that people with disabilities can have different types of cruelty. You guys want to hear the story in a nutshell?
Okay.
In a nutshell, he told the king, I want you to send with me two people who you trust, or one person who you trust, I don't remember. And I want you to give me a large sum of money. So he takes the large sum of money, he goes with the person that the king trusts, he goes to a blind person, and he tells him, look, I have to go before the king to be judged, and I don't know if I'm going to make it out alive. If I don't make it out alive, you could have this money. But if I do make it out alive, I want you to give me back this money. So the blind person tells Rabbi Yeshua, no problem, you can trust me, I'll hide it for you. And if you come back alive, the money is waiting for you. And he doesn't realize that there's this king's officer next to Rabbi Yeshua who hears every word. Time passes and Rabbi Yeshua comes back to the blind person and he tells him, sir, you know, I made it back out alive. Do me a favor, I'll be happy to give you, but you know, give me back my money. And the blind man says, I don't know you. So he says, what do you mean you don't know me? I gave you the money. You told me I could trust you and everything. And the man says, what are you talking about? We never met. We never spoke. I never had any conversation with you before in my life. And Rabbi Yeshua takes him to court before the king. And the blind man says before the king, "Your Honor, what fool would give a blind man money to watch? I don't even see where I'm going. Who would ever entrust me with money? It never happened." And the king hears it and he says to Rabbi Yeshua, "Well, what do you have to say for yourself?" So Rabbi Yeshua says, "Well, you told me you trust this man. This man was with me. He saw it. He witnessed it. This is what happened." So the man comes forward and he says, "Yeah, it's true. It's exactly what happened." So the king says, "Fine." He tells the blind man, "Either give Rabbi Yeshua back the money or you're going to be hung." And the blind man swears it never happened. This is all a lie. And they start taking him out to the gallows. So they're taking him out to the gallows. And Rabbi Yeshua says, "Now, Your Majesty, watch." He says, "Take one a guy who knows the blind man. Go over and have him whisper to the blind man in his ear that his wife, she's just waiting for him to be hung, and then she has a guy, she has a love affair, she wants to go cheat with someone and enjoy all the money for herself. And she's just waiting for him to be hanging at the gallows." So the blind man is being led out to the gallows, and he hasn't said a word. He's insisting that he's innocent. As he's being led out to the gallows, someone comes out and whispers that into his ear. So the blind man says, "Stop, stop! He told the truth. I'll show you where the money is." So Yeshua says to the king, "You see, he was willing to give up his life, but not give me back the money which you know he has." Right? And there are other stories, but in a nutshell, so this is the concept that Chazal warned us about. On the one hand, we have to have a sensitivity. We have to treat them. We have a special commandment in the Torah, "Lo tekalel cheresh," which on the simple level means don't curse him even though he doesn't hear you. But Chazal interpreted it to mean that he's going to sense that you did something derogatory to him and you're going to hurt his feelings, and it's a special commandment not to hurt his feelings, to be extra sensitive. And we, on the one hand, we have to be sensitive. On the other hand, we have to also know that there is that potential here. Yes?
Wouldn't 9 out of 10 people maybe have done the same as the blind man even if they didn't have a disability?
It's a good question. I don't know. I have to think about that. I don't know.
I'm not sticking to 9 out of 10. Just a lot of people, or a significant amount. Maybe just as many disabled and non-disabled people would have done the same thing. And it wasn't because of his disability. It was because of his lack of morality.
I hear. I have to look over the story again. I don't know. I mean,
just an idea.
There's... there's another story which I think on one hand supports what you're saying, on the other hand is against what you're saying. But the Rabbi Yeshua brought a few proofs. I mean, this is one story. We're just quoting one story. There were other stories. You're right, there are other cruel people. No one's saying that this is only them. There are a lot of people in society who could be cruel. There are a lot of people who can be immoral and unfair. And you're saying this isn't necessarily a proof that all blind people are going to be cruel. 100%, I agree. This isn't the only point that he pointed out, but we're coming in the middle of a conversation between Rabbi Yeshua and the emperor. This is one stage in the proof. I agree with you that if this were the only proof, then it wouldn't be a proof at all. What you remind me of is a conversation that Rabbi Yeshua had with the emperor, where the emperor asked him how long it takes for a snake the gestation period. How long does it take for him to give birth? Rabbi Yeshua told him how many years, and the emperor said, "Well, our scientists all did experiments, and they came up with a different number." So Rabbi Yeshua said, "Yeah, they took pregnant snakes into the experiment. When you have a snake that you're certain is not pregnant, and then start the experiment, then you'll see that I'm right." And they verified, and he was right. So he proved it from the Torah. But you're right. Here too, Rabbi Yeshua's proof was from a different place. This was a way of showing it to the king. You're right. It doesn't prove it. I think you're right. Yeah. The Torah warns us against giving a stumbling block before a blind man, and Chazal applied this not only to a blind man, but Chazal said we all have our areas where we are somewhat blind. Chazal said this in reference to shidduch, that sometimes you could recommend to someone to marry a girl and you have an interest in getting her married, and it's not good for him necessarily to marry that girl. Maybe you're withholding some information from him. Chazal said this can apply to a business deal. Let's say you want to buy someone's field, and he comes to you and asks you, "Do you think I should sell?" So you say, "Yeah, now's a good time to sell." And you're planning on, you've already spoken to the real estate agent. Once he sells, I'm the first one on the market. These are extreme examples, but the truth is, in every instance that someone comes and asks us for advice, we have to be very careful that we're not nogavadvam, that we're giving him the advice that's best for him. We once had a store, and when we sold the store, we sold it... we were considering selling it to a friend of mine. So when we began the conversation, I told my friend, look, the Torah prohibits us b'fnei iver lo titen michshol. And you're coming here to hear about the store from me. So I'm going to try to be honest, but the nature of the human being is that he views things a certain way when he wants to do a certain deal. So I want to forewarn you at the beginning of the conversation, I am nogea b'davar, I am partial. I'm not impartial. Don't look at me as a friend. Look at me as a con artist who owns this store and wants you to buy it. I'm going to try to be honest. But at the same time, I am partial. I do want to sell the store, and I want you to buy it. So I'm going to present it in a way that is going to make it look more appealing to you, even though I'm going to try not to. And I think that often in life, if we're meticulously honest in this area, we win. We don't lose. And when we sometimes are even a hair's breadth less than meticulously honest, it comes back to haunt us. And I've seen it in my own life. There are many instances where we have opportunity to be careful and tell the other side, look, I am partial, I just want you to know. And then we've already laid the cards on the table. When they call me about shiduchim, about you guys, so sometimes I'll tell them, I really like this guy, so I have to tell you, you should ask someone else. I'll tell you a lot of good about him. But I'm partial. I can't be honest. You're talking about a guy, come on. I'm partial. What can I do? But afterwards, I say a lot of good. But you got to be fair. The Torah warns us at the end of this commandment: be a God-fearing person, because this is an area where no one's going to necessarily know other than God. When you give someone advice, you could have meant their benefit or you could have meant their harm, and you might know and you might not know. But God is the only one that for sure knows. So we have to be very careful with this. Hashem says, I'm looking after this. And sometimes the person won't know, the person you gave advice to. But you know. So this is a warning not only about the simple understanding about the blind, but I always feel that this teaches us another point, and that is we should all remember that we're blind. Every one of us feels like there are areas where we know what we're doing. And we should remember, we all have areas, we all have our blind spots. And you see, the Torah called each and every one of us a blind man, right? The Torah says, don't put a stumbling block before your friend who's blind. He's blind in a certain area. You come to a car mechanic, you're blind, you don't know. You come to a doctor, you don't know. He tells you, you need this operation. Always be careful if he's the one operating, right? We had a guy here in the Machon this year. Went to a doctor, he said, you need an operation, and I'll do it for you, no problem. I said, oh, hold yours. Let's get a second opinion. Somehow the second opinion gave a different opinion. Very interesting. So, okay. The Torah warns us to be fair in justice. And the Torah says, don't think you're doing God's job by helping the poor or helping those that deserve honor. The Torah says, no. That's called destroying justice. And this connects to a concept that the Torah teaches us, and that is that the judges here on earth are doing God's work. Chazal say a person who maintains true justice in the world is like a partner to God. Because in essence, after God created the world, so to speak, he gave it over to us to run. One of the seven Noahide laws is to have a justice system. And so when we see a situation where someone can get away with doing something unfair, we turn back to God and we point our finger at God and we say, what's going on here, God? But the truth is, God says, what's going on here, man? I give you responsibility to set up a justice system. And that's why you'll notice that the justice system is sometimes called Elohim. Elohim could mean God, or the judges are sometimes called Elohim. They are the force down here on earth that's supposed to represent God. They're supposed to instill fairness in the world. God made this world where we have Bechira Chofshit. So I could rip someone else off. I could cheat in my business. But then the judges have a responsibility to grab that and rectify it and fix it. So they're playing the role of being partners to God. And that's why our sages said, if you do true justice, you're a partner with God in creating the world. That's how Chazal treated it. Now, the Torah gives us a special mitzvah in this week's parasha, Bitzedek tishpot amitecha. Judge your fellow man with righteousness. Well, isn't that what we were just discussing? So our sages said, within justice, there are always levels of justice. And your job, if you have a court case, is to try and find the most just court that there is. Don't say, well, I think he'll rule in my favor, that's just enough for me. No. try and find the best court you can find. Try and find the court that will really bring justice to the world. And that demands a high level of fairness. There's a famous story, I think it's about the Nesibos, one of the commentaries on the monetary laws in Shulchan Aruch, that he had a court case with someone, and the guy said, you know, it's not fair. Everyone knows you're this big rabbi. Any court we go to over here is going to rule in your favor, and that's not fair. So he said, you're right. We have to go out of town where no one knows me. So they went out of town. They went away to a faraway town where they heard there was a good court, and they came before the court, and it comes time for ruling, and the judge rules against the Nesivos. So the Nesivos says, Your Honor, I respect whatever you rule, but could you explain to me how this fits here and here and here? So the judge said, look, I'll tell you the truth. I'm not 100%. You got a good claim, but there's this great work that came out not far away from here, a little further down Europe, called the Nesivos. He was quoting the man's own work. And if you open it up over here, you'll see that this is the logic that he set up, and according with his logic, I have to rule this way. So you see the Nesivos himself, he wrote the work, and yet when it came to his own court case, he viewed it differently. And his own work was used against him. The judge didn't realize he was talking to the author himself, in an honest, fair court of law. But the Nesivos was also interested in justice. Chazal say, Adam karov etzel atzmo, every one of us is partial to ourselves, whether we like it or not. And so we have to seek out true justice. And true justice means, believe it or not, that I could be wrong. That's what everyone can't believe. When they enter court, everyone believes that they are 100% right. Part of being a fair person is recognizing that I could be wrong, right? The Torah warns us not to speak lashon hara, rechilut, about our fellow man. And here the Torah really is warning us against gossip, against saying anything that could cause harm to our fellow man. And this is a heightened sensitivity with regard to the laws of damages. We know there's a biblical prohibition against causing damage to our fellow man. Here the Torah is saying, don't do something that could lead to damage. If I walk out in the street and I say, that butcher shop is selling rotten meat, that's direct damage, right? That I can't do, that's obvious. That's damaging a person. If I walk out into the street and I say, he's a thief, don't go in there, they always cheat you, that's direct damage. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is that I have a friend who owns a butcher shop, and I think that his math skills aren't too great, but he's fair in his butcher shop. I just think he's not the greatest accountant. He's not running his business too well. It's not too complimentary, but it doesn't harm anyone else. It only harms him. I walk out there, what harm did I do if I say, you know, he's not the best accountant. He could run a much better store if he knew accounting better. Did I harm him directly? No. But let's say tomorrow he'll want a partnership with someone. And that person heard me say he's not the best accountant in the world. He won't want to make a partnership with him. So technically you could say, why should I care? Do I really have to worry that the person who heard me will one day want to make a business partnership with him and then it'll cause him harm? You understand it's a little bit far-reaching. The Torah says yes. Anything that a person wouldn't want you to say about him, in general, is included in this prohibition. And that teaches us a heightened sensitivity that the Torah wanted us to have. Technically, this minute, you didn't harm him. The potential is that in the future, it will cause harm. Being that this is a heightened sensitivity, technically, it's not encompassed by the laws of damage. This isn't libel. This isn't you're giving him a bad name. It's just something he would prefer. You didn't tell other people. So the Torah tells us this is only if you're part of the club. You guys know about the club? It's called being Jewish. Technically, the Torah considered us all club members. We're all brothers. So the Torah said, for your brethren, you got to go beyond the call of duty. It's not enough not to do harm. You have to go beyond that. You can't even say something that in the future might lead to harm. But being that this isn't really direct damage, and no law in the world, there's no place, you know, if any country would impose this as law, you wouldn't have newspapers. What could they write about? Today, Chaim helped Yankel cross the street. You could only write positive things. What could you write? You can't have newspapers. All the newspapers are about doing just this and worse. So no society in the world expects this of anyone. The Torah expects this of us, but the Torah is telling us that this is beyond the normal functioning of society. This is the type of behavior that the Torah expects for club members, and that's why technically this mitzvah doesn't apply to non-Jews. I would say that here in Machon Meir, where people are in the gear process, the person shouldn't like say, "Ah, I could say what I want about it." I wouldn't say that. The Torah warns us, "Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," which Don't stand idly by while your friend's blood is being spilled. And this is very far-reaching. You know, whenever we have an opportunity to help save someone's life, so we're supposed to take it. So in the spirit of this mitzvah would be to donate blood, to technically right now no one's life is in danger, so you're not in fulfillment of this mitzvah, but it's the spirit of the law. And here we, Chazal tell us a concept of a chassid shoteh. You guys familiar with that? A pious fool. The Talmud says, what's a pious fool? That's a guy who's walking by the riverbank and there's a naked woman drowning. And he says, I can't look. So the Talmud says that's a pious fool. Torah says there's a biblical prohibition of standing idly by when someone else's blood is being spilled. And this again will have many applications. A guy who's a doctor can't say, I won't treat just because you won't pay me. You know, if a guy's life is in danger, you got to deal with the person. Again, how you apply this practically, so each one will have to talk to his local Orthodox rabbi. But at the end of the day, the Torah is saying it's not just about murder, it's also about you're not allowed to stand idly by while someone else's blood is being spilled. The Torah warns us not to hate our brethren in the heart. What's called hating someone? That you don't talk to them for 3 days. That's called you hate someone. If you can't talk to them for 3 days, that's called hate. And the Torah warns us, don't hate someone. If you saw the guy eating pork on Yom Kippur, talk to him. See how you could bring him back. This mitzvah of tochacha is in our parsha. The Torah says, rebuke your fellow man. And don't do it in a way that will lead to sin. You rebuke him publicly, you're going to embarrass him. That's sin. So you have to do it in a way that's positive. Our sages say that this can only apply if you know how to give rebuke and he knows how to receive rebuke. And there are so many details to this mitzvah that technically today we don't know how to apply this. It's rare that we can apply this mitzvah of giving rebuke to our fellow man. Torah says we're not allowed to take revenge. What's revenge? Revenge is you stuck out your tongue at me, I'll stick out my tongue at you. No. Revenge is in monetary issues. I want to borrow your rake and you say no. So when you want to borrow my screwdriver, I say no. It's monetary. The spirit is beyond that. But technically, this is monetarily. Torah says, don't bear a grudge. What does it mean to bear a grudge? Again, same concept, only instead of not giving the screwdriver, I'll give it. And I'll say, I'm not like you. I show that I'm still bearing a grudge. This mitzvah, again, the spirit of it, yeah, you got to think about your wives. Right? She wakes you up 3 times in the middle of the night to change the baby's diaper. So the next night, the next morning, you tell her, I want you to know, the baby woke up another 3 times and I did not wake you in the middle of the night. it's about an attitude. The mitzvah is technically monetarily. The Torah tells us, V'avta l'racha kamocha. Love your friend like yourself. And Rabbi Akiva taught us this is a great rule that we know Hillel said this encompasses the whole Torah. Love your friend like yourself. So our sages said, technically the Torah gives us a mitzvah. If a person does certain transgressions, so there are different types of death penalty. One type of death penalty is, there are all kinds of death penalties. In each death penalty, our sages sat down and analyzed. If any person, the sages said, if they were the person being executed, what's in the person's best interest? What's the kindest way to execute him? And every type of execution, our sages actually sat down and asked themselves, what's better for the person? What would a person prefer? To the extent where sometimes the death penalty would pass more quickly if the person was naked. So they asked themselves, well, does a person prefer the shame or does a person prefer to die quicker? Which one? And they had discussions over this. And in one place, the Talmud says, but there was a case where they didn't apply this, where they gave the death penalty in a more cruel fashion. So the Mishnah right away says, yeah, that was a court that wasn't professionals. That was a court of Sadducees. They don't accept the oral law. So they just took the psukim literally. So loving our fellow man involves a lot of thought. It's not just, I love everyone. It involves thought. And the practical applications also involve thought. There's a famous Kotzker Vart, the Kotzker Rebbe, the Rebbe of Kotzk. He said, the Torah says, love your fellow man like yourself. From here we know that the Torah expects you to love yourself. The Torah warns us about crossbreeding, and this applies to Jews and non-Jews as well. You can't have hired work crossbreeding animals. Technically, crossbreeding means that you take the animal's male organ and stick it into the female organ. If you just put them both in the same corral and then they crossbreed, that's okay. The prohibition against crossbreeding is actually doing it. The Torah warns us against planting kelaim, planting two types of things that will grow together, and the Torah warns us against wearing shatnez. So why are we prohibited from wearing shatnez, wool and linen together? So Maimonides says the standard garment that the priests used to wear in idol worship was shatnez, wool and linen mixed together. So Torah says, don't wear this garments that have wool and linen mixed together, because that was the way the pagans used to dress in their pagan ways. Today, if you buy an expensive wool suit, so you have to know that the boss suits, Hugo Boss, yeah, the very expensive suits, $800 suits, it's almost 100%. There was a time, I don't know what's about today, but there was a time that it was almost 100% that it was wool and linen mixed together. The wool suits had linen lapels. So that's shatnez. If you buy a suit, so there are laboratories all around that will check it for you. If you buy it here in Israel, so you could tell the store owner, I want a condition that if I find shatnez, I could bring it back. And that's before you do tailoring, guys. You know, you can't bring it back after you've tailored it. There's a shatnez laboratory here in Kiryat Moshe and in Har Nof and in Beit Vegan and in Romema by the mall and in Me'ah Shearim. Some are better than others. Some will destroy the suit, so you better do some research before you give them. I once did the mistake of giving a bunch of ties to the shatnez laboratory and they destroyed all of them. So you got to know who you're giving it to. And check with your local Orthodox rabbi. Not every garment has to be checked. You know, if you have a garment that's 100% polyester, you don't have to check it. Yeah, it's got to have either wool or linen. Now, the factory is, it seems to be an international plague that no one really cares what they write on the label. You know, it seems to be that in every country they don't enforce this. They could write 100% wool and it's 70% wool or 30% wool or 0% wool. There's a lot of hanky-panky going around and it's not being enforced as far as I know in any country in the world. I don't know why, but that's the way it is. So you can't rely on the label alone. Proof of the pudding is there used to be a store, a 2-minute walk from here, that used to sell 100% cashmere sweaters for 20 shekel. Explain that to me. Okay. Their label said it, you know. Bezalel, yes?
Question. What about silk? This kind of,
silk is silk. It has to be wool and linen. Sheep wool and linen.
Only
these two.
I've read that also it applies to derricks from the animal and from the vegetable.
Never heard of such a thing. As far as I know, the Mishnah in Kilayim says not that way. And the Shulchan Aruch, if I'm not mistaken, says not that way. Okay. Must be sheep's wool and linen.
Must not.
Right, must not be, right. Beautiful. Oh, the Kohen Gadol also wore shatnez, but that's because the Torah said so. But it's an interesting point. I never thought of that. It's a good point. Wow. Yes?
You said, when you said rebuke, just go over that line again quickly.
Technically, if you see your fellow man transgressing Shabbos, so you're supposed to tell me, you know, it's Shabbos today. You're not really supposed to be driving today. It's biblically prohibited, but today we're not on a level to give rebuke, and they're not on a level to hear rebuke, so practically we don't really do it. Consult with your local Orthodox rabbi, because 99% of the time you shouldn't be saying anything, even if you see your fellow man doing something wrong. The Torah gives us the mitzvah of Orla. We come into the land of Israel, we plant a fruit-bearing tree. The first 3 years, we're not allowed to eat from the fruit. What happens if it doesn't give off fruit the first 3 years? No problem, doesn't matter. First 3 years, no eating the fruit. The fourth year, the fruit is holy and must be eaten in Jerusalem. And the fifth year, you could eat the fruit. This is applicable in Chutz La'aretz with regard to grapevines. That's only fruit we apply to in grapevines. But you have to know, because some fruits only grow, the crop only produces the first year. There are fruits that only produce the first year. So you have to know, the rabbinate puts out every year what are the percentages of orla in the world. What percentage of which fruit? This is part of what a hechsher has to cover. The Torah prohibits us from cutting off the corners of our hair on the head. And this means, it has nothing to do with the razor blade, it means that you're supposed to leave when you have a hairline in the front of your head, and you have a hairline over your ear. You're not from. If you would draw a line from the hairline at the widow's peak down to the hairline in the back of the ear, from there downward, the hair on the head may not be cut too short. You have to have a hair that's long enough that you could fold it on itself. That's the biblical commandment of Peas HaRosh. Then the Torah tells us to not destroy the corners of your beard. What are the corners of the beard? So Chazal said there are five places on the beard where we have corners of the cheekbone and the jawbone, and we don't know where those five places are. And the Torah says you're not allowed to cut that with a razor blade. If you want to put on powder, that'll take it off, depilatory cream, that's fine. But you're not allowed to destroy it with a razor, with a knife. So we're not allowed to shave with a razor, because we don't know which parts of the face are included. We know there are five places on the face. We don't know how wide they are. We don't know exactly where they are. So it's biblically prohibited to shave with a razor. Now, the custom is that children, when they're young and they don't have beards, so then they grow their peis a little bit long to cover, so to speak, to cover their shame, that they don't have the corner of the hair over here. But technically, it's not necessary. Technically, biblically, the prohibition is cutting the hair too short. Rabbinically, our custom is that we grow, it's a custom, that we grow the hair down to here. That's the little peis that kids have, down to here. That's the idea. The Torah warns us not to scratch ourselves over someone's death. We're not allowed to cause ourselves to bleed over someone's death. The Talmud records that when Rabbi Lazar passed away, Rabbi Akiva, his disciple, scratched himself and was bleeding. So Tosfos asks, how did he do that? So Tosfos says he wasn't crying over his personal relationship to Rabbi Lazar. He was crying over the Torah being lost. The Torah's burial with Rabbi Eliezer's burial is what he was crying over, and that's why his bleeding wasn't over someone's death, it was over the Torah that was lost, which is an interesting concept. The Torah prohibits making tattoos, biblical prohibition. This is part of what the pagans used to, but the Torah prohibits any type of tattoos. If a person has a tattoo, he does not have to remove it. A person doesn't have to undergo all those laser treatments to remove it. But if a person has a tattoo, he should know it's something to be embarrassed about. It is a biblical prohibition, and he should keep it covered. You don't go around showing off the things you did wrong in life. If you didn't know, so you don't have to be embarrassed about it. A guy grew up, he knew nothing about Judaism. It's not his fault, but he still shouldn't go off showing it off. It's nothing to be proud about. We're short on time, Bitzalel. Okay, so after class. The Torah warns us that we have a responsibility to ensure our daughters do not go out into prostitution. Part of that responsibility is to ensure our daughters get married. A guy leaves over his daughter till she's 30 and he can't provide for a normal wedding or a normal chasen, so he's got a problem. Our sages said, your daughter got old, she didn't find ideal shidduch, get her a less than ideal shidduch, but get her married. Don't hold out for the best shidduch. A girl has to be married. It's not right to leave her around without a chasen. And it's a father's responsibility to get his children married. The Torah here tells us, keep Shabbos and fear my temple. And here we see that building the temple does not push off keeping Shabbos, and that the laws of Shabbos hang on the functions of the temple. That's how we derive the 39 actions that are prohibited on Shabbos, because it's not exactly from this pasuk, but it's from this concept. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to do all kinds of EGBG, you know, all kinds of calling the demons, bringing up the dead, asking the dead, all kinds of stuff. So here there's a machlokas geonim rishonim. Were the ones who did this, did they really bring back the dead, or were they fakers? Were they all charlatans, or was there really a way of talking to the dead? So the Talmud seems to say that they really had a way of accessing the dead. But it's a big machlokas, whether this was really something that worked, or they were good ventriloquists. They were able to fool people. We once had a student who did alternative medicine, and a guy came to him, and he thought the only way to help him was to convince him that he should do A, B, or C. So he sat down with him, and he said, now I'm going to call back this spirit and that spirit, and he convinced him, and he helped him work his life out. So I told him, you know, you might have been in transgression of a biblical commandment. This could be part of idol worship. So he said, but it was all a fake. I was only faking him out to get him to do it. It was for his benefit. So I said to him, yeah, but according to Maimonides, all of this is a fake. You know, there are opinions, Geonim, who say that the biblical prohibition in our parsha is these fakes, that they were never real people who did it. Nachmanides is of the opinion that there are forces out there you could tap into, and that seems to be the simpler reading of the Talmud, that there are forces out there a person could tap into, what we would call the forces of impurity, and a person could do things with them. And the Talmud says the rabbis, it was part of their tradition, they knew how to do it. It says they knew how to walk by an empty patch, say an incantation, and it would fill up with cucumbers. Then they'd say another incantation, and all the cucumbers would be collected, and they'd have a harvest of cucumbers. The Talmud says they knew how to do it with impure names, and then Talmud says there was a pure way of doing it. We have on tradition a book from Adam that's called Sefer HaYetzirah, with which one can create animals and human beings. How do you do it? I'm not allowed to tell. So I don't know, but we still have that book. We just don't know exactly what it means. Torah tells us we have to stand up in honor of someone that's older than us. We have to give honor. We have to value someone that's old, and it doesn't have to be someone that's Jewish. An old person walks into the room, we're supposed to stand up. Onto the bus, we're supposed to stand up. We have a special mitzvah in our parsha to treat the gerim with kindness and not to afflict them. We have a special mitzvah to love the ger. Torah says in numerous places, a special mitzvah to love the ger. So aside from the mitzvah to love our fellow man, we have a mitzvah to love the ger. Aside from the practical applications, and by the way, this applies to the gerim as well. You know, a ger is a Jew, so he has the mitzvahs of every other Jew, so he's also supposed to love a ger, right? That applies to the... Just like a poor man has a mitzvah to give tzedakah, right? He can't say, well, I'm poor. No, so the Shulchan Aruch says, right, you're poor, but put together a coin and give tzedakah at least once a year. By the same token, a ger also has the mitzvah to love his fellow ger. What's the practical application other than to do this? When you do it, you should have in mind you're fulfilling a biblical mitzvah of doing kindness. And in a nutshell, we've basically covered the first four aliyos of the parsha, four-sevenths of the parsha, which is most of the parsha. And the rest, we'll see. Maybe we'll get to tomorrow night. So that's the question. You